Court relayed everything Fan had told him about why he ran, the family collateral he lost, and his strong desire to be done with all this. When he stopped talking, she said, "Okay, well, as I told you several times, your job was not to make contact with Fan. It was to get positive ID and then notify me so I could send in others." Court said,
"And now I know why you didn't want me in contact with Fan myself."
"Meaning?" she asked, though she knew the answer.
"Meaning I've been lied to from the beginning. I was not told that Major Song Julong, the man watching Fan's parents, was an agent for the West. I wasn't told that Fan only got out of the mainland with the help of a service friendly and intimate with the CIA. Why is that?"
Brewer said, "I did not have authorization to tell you. That's really all you need to know."
Court asked, "Was this a Taiwanese op that we jumped in to save, or was this a joint op where we were involved with the fuck-up from the start?"
Brewer remained silent.
"You have to tell me."
Now she spoke.
"Yes. Major Song contacted someone at Taiwanese intelligence and told him Fan Xiang would try to cross the border with no papers. They threw something together, didn't reach out to us for help, didn't reach out to anyone. They got him over the border, but Fan was followed over by some of Colonel Dai's men. The Taiwanese intelligence agents waiting for him had to call off the pickup, leaving Fan all alone. He panicked and left, and the Taiwanese weren't able to reconnect with him. They came to us, finally, and when Fitzroy was pulled into the operation on the Chinese side, we saw an opportunity to help find Fan Xiang by having you make contact with Fitzroy."
"And why wasn't I told all this from the beginning?"
"It wasn't relevant."
"Usually when someone withholds information from me, it's because they are hiding something bigger. What am I missing?"
"You aren't missing anything. We couldn't expose Taiwanese intelligence if you were captured when you went in to see Fitzroy. The knowledge that Taiwan helped with the defection could have started a shooting war between the two Chinas."
Court sighed, but he seemed to let the matter drop. "Look, Fan definitely does not want to go to the USA. He wants to go to Taiwan."
Brewer sniffed now. "You sound like you give a shit. It's not your job to give a shit. It was your job to find him so SAD can pick him up."
"It makes things tougher that he is unwilling. If this is a joint operation, he needs to go to Taipei. It shouldn't be that big a deal."
"No promises,"
Brewer said, and then she began railing at Violator about losing his means of communication during the op.
"We could have picked up Fan hours before he was kidnapped by the Thais if you'd had your phone."
"I know that. Shit happens in the field, Brewer."
"That is what people say when they screw up. It becomes an excuse for their incompetence."
Court let it go. She was his handler, and she was right. He'd fucked up, and he'd let her criticize him about it, even though she was probably sitting there in a nice office with a cranberry muffin and a cup of coffee in front of her. He said, "I'm going to Bangkok. I'll talk to Colonel Dai and get help from the Chinese. If you've got somebody better than me to nab Fan Xiang, you go ahead and get them on it."
"How can you go to Bangkok? The Thai gangsters who took Fan Xiang have seen you."
"The guys who saw me in Cambodia were smugglers, river rats. Fan will be handed over 3 more times before he makes it into Bangkok. Fan will be in Bangkok with senior management. I'm not worried about being compromised."
Brewer blew out a long sigh. "Violator, you probably don't need me telling you this, but this operation is not going well. I'm talking to Hanley as soon as he gets to the office."
"To tell him what?"
Brewer did not respond.
"To tell him what?"
"To tell him we need to rethink our next steps."
"You can sit there and think about whatever the hell you want. I'm going after Fan Xiang."
"If you are told to stand down, you will stand down."
"Matt won't pull me off this. The stakes are too high."
"Exactly. They are too high to have one operator, one who is possibly exposed to the opposition, running around on a solo mission to grab this high-value target. Your initial job was to find out what the Chinese and Fitzroy knew about the location of Fan Xiang. That intel is a week old and half a continent removed from where you are now. At this point, I consider your continued pursuit of the target an unnecessary compromise."
"I got damn close, Brewer. Hell, I had my hands on that kid's neck."
"And yet here we are."
She let the comment hang in the air,
the crackling phone line the only noise in Court's ear for a moment. Then she said, "Do you think it is a simple thing to order a Marine Corps helicopter to fly an in-extremis exfiltration op into a nation like Cambodia?
You think that was what I and the rest of the agency needed to be focusing on last night?
And with that, Violator hung up the phone. Brewer looked across her desk at a sheet of paper lying there. On it was the direct line to the XO of the USS Boxer. With one call to him, she could have a dozen Marines with M-16s pull Violator off his bunk and throw him in the brig till the ship docked. The CIA SAD team in the area could then bring him back to the States and watch over him till the operation was concluded. But she did not make the call. To do that, she'd need the backing of Director Hanley, and she was not going to disturb him at home. It would make her appear weak and indecisive. She grabbed her crutches and headed back to her sofa. She'd allow herself a few hours of sleep before she got back up, and as soon as Hanley came to work, she'd talk to him and shut this entire operation down. With a little luck, she'd be permanently free of Violator by mid-morning, and her career would be back on track. Chapter 35. Court spent the entire afternoon in a small windowless compartment deep in the bowels of the USS Boxer. His door was shut, and he never saw the captain, the XO, or the lieutenant colonel commanding the battalion of Marines on board. He barely even spoke to the Marine who led him down the ladderways and up the passageways to this little claustrophobic space. He assumed Brewer had arranged everything. His compartment had a single bunk and an attached head, a small refrigerator with water, a coffin locker stacked with packaged food, civilian clothing, and medical equipment. A small desk attached to the wall was adorned with a laptop with internet access and two phones, a smartphone and a satellite phone. Accessories for the phones and computer lay on top of a small backpack. Court wondered if someone on the Boxer had gotten all this equipment from sailors on board in exchange for cash from the CIA. Logistics and outfitting wasn't his department, but he was used to working alone, and he had to take into account the possibility for compromise in every phase of the operation. Court spent half the afternoon appreciating the fact that he was able to lay low here. The other half of the afternoon, he questioned whether he was a prisoner. He wondered if Brewer had given orders to the Marines to watch over him and keep him, essentially, in a cell here on the amphibious assault ship till she found a way to get him shit-canned from his assignment. He figured he'd only know the truth when it was time to leave. If he found himself on his own in Bangkok, then Brewer was leaving him in play. If a dozen young, testosterone-filled, bald-headed dudes in brown held guns on him and ordered him to stay on board till someone came to collect him, then he would know this was over. That would mean Fon might be lost to the Thais, or to the Russians, or to the Chinese. It would also mean, with absolute certainty, that Sir Donald Fitzroy was a dead man. Court worried it might already be too late for Fitz. Going over a day without checking in with Dai might just send the Chinese colonel down to the basement of his big house on the peak, with a gun in his hand and Sir Donald's head in his sights. By early evening, when they were just a few miles from port in Bangkok, Court was finally able to connect with a Thai cell network, and he locked himself into his small room and dialed a number on the smartphone using the unbreakable off-the-shelf encryption app he'd been using throughout this operation. Court sat down on his bunk and waited, knowing he was initiating a very difficult and important conversation. Dai answered immediately.
Wei ni hao.
Yes, hello. Court decided he needed to go on offense from the outset to keep Dai focused on his operation.
Your boys did something stupid yesterday in Saigon. It's made my work a lot more difficult. Where are you?
I'm on a dry goods hauler, heading for Bangkok.
Why are you going to Bangkok?
Because I'm on Fan Xiang's heels, let me guess. You don't even know he's in Thailand. Are your guys still running around Vietnam looking for him?
Fan is in Bangkok? With who?
I'll need your help for that. I chased him into Cambodia, then he got picked up on a river by a group of criminals run out of Bangkok. I think he was kidnapped. That's pretty much all I know. Court worried Dai would want a play-by-play of last night's events, and he was right.
Back up and tell me everything that happened.
Shit, thought Court. Here goes nothing. Court knew how to lie. He used vast swaths of truth to sell the verisimilitude of the event, and only changed details that would have compromised him in the smallest manner possible. Court explained that he had discovered the old colonial villa in the Mekong Delta after tailing the BMW sedan to the area, but he was caught inside the property and unable to move after the arrival of the People's Army Infantry. This was true, more or less. Then he recounted the arrival of the Russians and relayed his concerns that they would try to kidnap Fan. The only major changes to the facts began when Fan and the other two men left the barn of the villa. Court's new version had Fan escaping alone to the west, making it miles into Cambodia with Court close on his tail, where Fan was picked up by a group of Thai gangsters in powerboats. He worried Dai would find it hard to believe Fan could accomplish so much by himself, and Court briefly considered telling Dai the Vietnamese man Fan escaped with had helped him for most of the way. But he wasn't sure Dai didn't have someone on the ground at the villa by now. If Court told the Chinese commander the two guys lying dead in the field behind the villa had helped Fan escape over the Cambodian border, Dai would know Court was full of shit. There was one huge flaw in Court's story, of course. He could not reasonably explain why he did not contact Dai at any point to bring dozens of armed Chinese agents down upon the scene to kill everything that moved and eliminate the compromise. No, he could not reasonably explain it, but he could unreasonably explain it.
My damn phone got wet in the rice paddies during the infiltration. I couldn't establish comms till I got a new one, which I stole from a sailor on this ship.
When the American finished his story and his explanation of why he'd been radio silent for a day, he waited quietly until Colonel Dai replied. And when Dai replied, it was instantly obvious that Court's powers of influence and persuasion weren't going to work on the Colonel.
I know everything there is to know about Fan Xiang, which means I know he could not possibly escape from Khan Ho Hong Da, the Russians, and you, then travel overland 7.5 miles, crossing a national border, only to be picked up on a river by Thai criminals. I do not believe your story for an instant. I do not know what your game is, but I do know that your efforts have failed to date, and a price must be paid for that. I will encourage you to do what you said you would do, by showing you my willingness to do what I said I would do.
What are you talking about?
Court asked, although he was afraid he knew exactly what Dai was talking about. Dai did not answer, which gave Court an immediate feeling of disquiet. There was a shuffling over the phone, and then someone said something in Mandarin, but Court could not tell who was speaking. Other voices now, their words indecipherable. The sound of footsteps. Court sat up straighter on the bunk.
Dai. Dai. Talk to me. Don't forget, I'm the one you're pissed at. I'm also the one close to the target. I'm the one you have to keep on mission, and if you do anything...
Court heard the first voice he recognized, the first words he understood. Sir Donald Fitzroy was far from the telephone, but he spoke loud enough for Court to hear him.
What's all this? What do you want?
Court shouted now into the phone.
I swear to you, Colonel, if you do it, I will fucking walk from this job, and you will never get Fan. He'll end up in Moscow or D.C. before the week's out. You'll be shot, and your nation's secrets will go to your enemies.
Either Court was not persuasive, or Colonel Dai was not listening. Fitzroy shouted in alarm, and then he screamed. Court knew the sounds of a grown man in abject terror, and he knew the sounds of a grown man in hyperbolic, excruciating pain. And over the next several seconds, Sir Donald Fitzroy made both sounds. Court stopped yelling into the phone. He put his head down between his knees, still sitting on the little bunk, still with his phone to his ear. The shrieks of pain and horror and pain continued for another half minute. Then it went quiet for a time, before Court could hear heavy, gruff breathing in the background. He sat up quickly. Sir Donald was still alive.
Done. Done.
And after what seemed like an eternity, Fitzroy came on the line. His words were spoken in soft wheezes. Court could hear thick mucus in his throat, and the old man was obviously in agony.
I am here, Court.
Court squeezed the phone tighter.
What did they do?
It took Fitzroy a long time to answer, and the stress in his voice made him hard to decipher.
Two fingers sawed off with a straight razor. My fucking hands bleeding like a headless chicken.
Court's jaw clenched and his eyes stared across the room at nothing.
I'm sorry, Don. I'm trying.
Sod the lot of them, Court. Just turn around and go. Leave all this shit behind. Look, this is bigger than you know. This whole operation is worse than you can possibly understand. Just go. Walk away from this insanity while you still can.
I can't do that.
Dai was back on the line now.
No, you cannot do that. You are being paid for a job. If you complete the job, you will also earn the bonus of retrieving Sir Donald, or most of him, or whatever is left of him. Whether you fly him first class out of Hong Kong on British Airways, or have him shipped in refrigerated freight on a cargo plane, that is a question of how well, and how quickly, you fulfill your end of the transaction.
Court wished he could reach through the line and gouge the colonel's eyes out. Instead, he just said,
I'll get Fan in Bangkok. Just calm the fuck down and give me some time.
Time has always been the one precious commodity in this endeavor. Now there are two, time and the body parts of your friend here. You give me results, or you will soon run out of both.
Court sighed. I've told you. He's my meal ticket, not my friend.
Yes, you told me that. But you gave away your true motivation by your tone just now. If Fitzroy was just the man who could secure future contracts for you, the loss of two of his fingers would not be nearly as stressful for you. That's not now. Go to work.
Colonel Dai disconnected the call. Court dropped the phone on the bunk next to him and leaned his head back against the wall of the little compartment. Chapter 36. Director of the CIA's National Clandestine Service, Matt Hanley, had promised Suzanne Brewer a direct feed to him, meaning she could bypass everyone in the normal chain of command, report to Hanley directly, or come to him if she ever needed anything. She knew better than to abuse this privilege, but this morning when she found that Hanley was attending a day-long meeting in D.C. and would not be in the office till midday, she drove herself straight to the location and called Hanley's secretary to secure 5 minutes of FaceTime with him. Two of Hanley's men met Brewer in the parking lot of the Department of State. One parked her car, while the other led her inside through a side entrance. She was on her crutches. The CIA officer offered to carry her purse, but she declined, although she did allow him to hold open the door for her, because there was no way she could have managed it on her own. A female aide to the D/NCS joined them, and they went past a large conference room with guards posted outside and into a small, unoccupied anteroom. A breakfast table had been set up with coffee, pastries, and bagels with butter, cream cheese, and jellies, and Suzanne was told to make herself as comfortable as possible. It was 10 a.m. She had eaten breakfast from a snack machine at her desk 3 hours earlier and downed enough coffee since 7 a.m. to make her twitchy, so instead, she just sat at the table and ignored the food. Matt Hanley lumbered in minutes later wearing a gray sport coat and dark slacks, his tie and collar cinched around his thick, ruddy neck in a manner that Suzanne Brewer felt had to be painful.
Hey, Suzanne, don't get up.
He headed straight for the breakfast setup, as she'd assumed he would. Brewer said,
Sorry to pull you out of your meeting.
He poured himself a cup of coffee, grabbed a pastry, and took it over to her table. As he did so, he said,
Not a problem. This is going to be a wasted day. I had no idea the amount of dumb shit I'd have to do in this job.
He took a bite of the apple Danish and sipped the coffee.
What's up with our boy?
Brewer blew out her air.
Where to start? Okay.
Violator tracked senior leadership of Khan Ho Hong Da to a protected compound near the Cambodian border. Violator, entered the compound, but shortly thereafter, some 25 or so Vietnamese military arrived, pinning him in position. Hanley's eyebrows rose, but he did not interrupt. As he tried to make his escape, a group of 9 paramilitaries hit the compound.
Chinks.
He meant Chinese, Suzanne Brewer knew, but still she was taken aback. She hid it.
Negative. Violator thinks they might have been Russian.
Shit. Same gang he saw in HK?
That is his assertion, yes. Hanley blew out a chest full of air.
Fucking Russians. We knew they might show up. Okay, Chinks and Ivans, go ahead.
Right. A protracted gunfight began, and in it, Violator somehow managed to make contact with the subject, Fan Xiang.
Contact?
He escaped the compound with Fan Xiang during the confrontation between this undetermined group and the Vietnamese.
Hanley took another bite of the pastry.
Damn, he's good.
Violator and Fan made it into Cambodia, where they encountered Thai criminals operating on a river. Violator feels sure this was not random. They had been sent there specifically to kidnap Fan. During this confrontation, Fan was taken by the Thais and Violator escaped.
And what did Gentry learn from Fan?
Fan told him he was aided by a Taiwanese intelligence officer at the Hong Kong border, and then he found himself alone in HK.
The director of NCS nodded slowly and thoughtfully.
We can work with that.
Right, Suzanne said. We dodged a bullet, clearly only because Fan doesn't understand what is going on. But Violator is suspicious. He doesn't get why Taiwan isn't still involved, and he doesn't get why we didn't tell him any of this. I told him what we agreed, and I think he bought it.
Hanley rubbed his face.
Where is Gentry now?
He's on a marine landing craft heading into Bangkok. He has no papers, no local currency.
Hanley did not show the outrage over Violator's failures that Brewer had expected, even hoped for. Instead, he just shrugged and said,
We can get him set up.
But why, Matt? We have assets all over Bangkok. Explain to me how any one of them isn't in a better position than Violator to locate and take possession of Fan Xiang. He's been seen by the Thais, and it's possible he's known to the Russians now. Violator was the key to getting us close to Fitzroy and the Chinese after Fan. That value has expired. Why don't we pull him out, and you can send other assets after Fan?
Hanley leaned forward on the table. Even though there was no one in the room, he was discussing a CIA special access program, so he spoke softly.
We need to keep our actions deniable in this, remember? Taking Fan without the Chinese knowing we took Fan will exponentially increase the value of the product we get from him. Gentry can help with that. The Chinese don't know he's with us. The Russians don't know he's with us. And even if the Thai gangsters compromised him somehow, well, they're Thai gangsters. I like court's chances against them.
Brewer pushed back on another front. Matt, we knew from the beginning that bringing this asset into this program would help us keep our involvement hidden. But in light of what this agent has done in his past, I am concerned he might not be as reliable as you insinuate.
Hanley had finished his Danish. Now he gulped his hot coffee.
In what way?
She hesitated, then said,
What if he's too successful? What if he uncovers the full truth about this operation?
She leaned forward herself.
There is a volatility to him, an unpredictability. What if he finds out he's being played, and he goes rogue?
Hanley said,
Strictly speaking, he's not being played. He's on the operation we sent him on. His mission is Fan. Anything beyond his narrow mission parameters is not his problem. Yes, we lied to him, but only because his moral code would put the lives of good people in jeopardy. We need him. We're doing the right thing. So he was manipulated somewhat. Not knowing what he doesn't know doesn't make him more safe. It makes him more comfortable with what he's doing.
Brewer said, But if he learns certain things about the full scope of this operation, then
Hanley spoke over her.
He will rebel.
He shrugged his huge shoulders.
But it's your responsibility to ensure he doesn't find out anything beyond his mission parameters.
Hanley took another gulp.
Anything more than he's already figured out, that is.
Yes, sir,
she said, but her heart wasn't in it. Hanley detected this.
Violator is unpredictable. You look at him as if he's a ticking time bomb, but I know he has to be the way he is in order to do the job we've given him. More than anyone I've ever seen, Court possesses the gift of aggression, and believe me, it is a gift. He'd be face down dead long ago if he hesitated, if he wavered or thought his moves through. He's as smart and crafty a tactician as exists in this world, but when it comes time for it, he can act and act and kill, no quarter given.
No argument there. My concern is that his gift for aggression has been used against us in the past, and it might be directed towards us again if he learns about certain aspects of Operation Aces High.
Hanley raised a finger. He won't ever hear anyone breathe a word of Aces High, because if he did, you're absolutely right. He'd go off reservation, he'd become a satellite adrift, and he'd plunge back to Earth like a motherfucking missile.
Brewer cocked her head. Help me with your metaphor. The CIA is Earth?
Hanley shook his head. No. You are. He winked. You're the handler.
Hanley looked to his watch.
Sorry, I've got to get back to that bullshit in the conference room. Outfit Gentry with whatever he needs. Help him locate the ties who are holding the target. Keep our official cover assets the hell out of his way, and let him do his thing. He'll find us, Fan Xiang. When he does, send in Ground Branch.
Yes, sir.
He pointed again. He was a big man, and the gesture was intimidating. But keep Court's blinders on. We don't want him to know how the fuck we fell into this whole mess in the first place.
Right, Suzanne said. Because if he knew that, he'd probably come back to D.C. and kill us all. The comment was sarcasm. Gentry had just left the D.C. area, and he had wreaked havoc trying to find answers to why the CIA turned on him years ago. Hanley ignored the quip and turned for the door.
Do keep me updated.
Brewer stood herself and reached for her crutches. With unmasked discomfort, she just said, Sure thing.
Chapter 37 Fan Xiang had arrived in the capital of Thailand from Cambodia, in an old Partenavia twin-engine aircraft, surrounded on the flight by Thai men with guns who had nothing to say to him about where he was going and what plans they had for him when he got there. From the airport, he'd been taken directly to a large commercial building somewhere in the heart of the city. There he was led to an elevator, then back out again on the fifth floor. He passed through a massive open room the size of a city block, with literally hundreds of men and women working at computer terminals in little cubes. Fan assumed there were more rooms like it on other floors of the building, but he could not know for sure because he wasn't given much of a tour. Instead, he was simply led through this large room and then down a barren concrete hallway. A back room at the end of the hall was guarded by a pair of armed men in security guard uniforms sitting in plastic chairs. Fan Xiang was directed through the door. That was 3 days ago, and he had not left this room since. This windowless space that had become his home was set up like a cell, which Fan found appropriate because he was indeed a prisoner. There was a sleeping mat on a cold tile floor and a bucket for his waist, just as he'd had on the boat that took him from Hong Kong to Vietnam. But this room differed from the storage space on the cargo ship in that he had a laptop computer on a desk that, it had been explained to him, was attached to the company's network. Even though the portions of the building he had walked through appeared to be just any other technology-based business, there was one feature in this tiny room that reminded him that he was being held by a criminal organization. A large steel eye bolt cemented into the floor in the center of the room. Fan bumped his feet on it while he sat at the desk, and he surmised others had been kept here at the desk in chains. It was a horrifying thought, but from what he knew about this place and the people who ran it, it was not surprising. The group that held Fan Xiang now was the Shamroon Syndicate, and Fan's earlier research into criminal organizations had taught him this was both one of the most successful and most notorious transnational organizations in Southeast Asia. Not only were they in the business of computer hacking, identity fraud, and spear phishing schemes, the syndicate was also heavily involved in heroin exportation and human trafficking, primarily bringing Eastern European women to serve as prostitutes for wealthy Asians and Asian women to work as prostitutes in Central and Western Europe. Fan knew enough about the group to understand they were horrible people, and this was before he'd even met any of their leadership.
Fan realized he was now involved with thugs many orders of magnitude more dangerous than the Vietnamese gang and the Hong Kong-based Triad organization who'd protected him before, and unlike those instances, where Fan was a willing participant to earn his safety and shelter, here, he was a simple captive. When he first arrived, a severe Mandarin-speaking woman told him what they wanted of him. His captors somehow knew exactly who he was and what value he could provide them. As his captors were in the business of, among other things, computer crime, it was no surprise they demanded he engage in criminal acts of fraud via the Internet. For the first 2 days, he'd given them nothing, and the woman had told him the men watching his work were getting frustrated with his lack of output. He decided he did not want to test their patience, so today, he decided he would show some progress. At 3 p.m., Fan leaned back in his chair and rubbed the fatigue in his eyes. He had been working non-stop for 9 hours, but his labors had borne fruit. He had just successfully breached a German-based mortgage company and pulled out all the personal data of over 134,000 individuals who had bought homes or condos in and around Berlin. With all the data on these German citizens, the men and women working in the massive boiler room down the hall could then open up credit cards, set up offshore shells in fictitious names, and purchase goods virtually using the fraudulent identities. The goods could be shipped and then sold, and the received funds wired into the offshore accounts in small increments that raised no suspicions. An hour after he sent all the personal data in a file to the men and women working in the boiler room, Fan Xiang shoveled stale rice into his mouth with his chopsticks. As he reached for a sip of tepid tea, he was surprised by the sound of the bolts sliding on the door to his room. The door opened, and a young man in a black suit, a tie, and a dark purple shirt entered, flanked by two other men, both wearing suits and ties themselves. Fan saw the butts of handguns sticking out of the belts of all three men. They all eyed Fan up and down as if he were a caged animal, but he knew the one in the middle was in charge.
"My name is Kulap Shamroon," the man said in English. "You might know that my father started this organization 35 years ago, but you might not know he is just a figurehead now. My brother and I share ownership of the Shamroon Syndicate."
Fan thought the man seemed defensive, agitated, a little jittery. He knew nothing about the man's father, nothing about the structure of the organization at all, for that matter. Still, Fan bowed.
"Yes, sir," Kulap Shamroon said. "The records you stole from the company in Germany have my people working very hard. That is good. How long till you get into the other networks on the list you are given?"
Fan cocked his head. He had been given a file with desirable targets on the first day he arrived, but there were hundreds of companies listed. Surely this man didn't expect Fan to break into all of them. That would take years. He said,
"I can try the next on the list, but may I ask how long I will be kept here?"
Kulap smiled, glanced to the two men with him, then raised an eyebrow.
"You don't like the accommodations?" "It's just, I wish to go to Taiwan. I had an arrangement with two other organizations. I would provide them with help in my field, and then they would repay me by helping me get to Taipei."
Kulap Shamroon nodded dramatically.
"An interesting proposition. You are saying you can work for me for a short time, and then I can help you be on your way. Is that it?" "Yes, sir." "Here's my counter-proposal."
The young man drew his pistol and stepped forward. He jammed it in Fan's left ear and pressed it hard, then took Fan's head with his other hand and pushed it in even deeper. The seated Chinese man let out a squeal of terror. Shamroon said,
"How about you work for me for as long as I tell you to? And in exchange for that, I don't kill you. Does that seem like a fair deal?"
Fan just sat in front of his computer, his eyes shut tight and his hands squeezing the desk.
"Yes, thank you, sir."
Shamroon pulled the gun away, spun it on a finger, and jabbed it back in his pants.
"Dai mak."
"Very good."
"Just remember, we don't fuck around here in Bangkok like they do in Saigon and Hong Kong. The syndicate is the biggest and the best. We have the most money, the most guns, and the most power. You do what you are told when you are told, or else you are a dead man. There is nothing else for you to worry about.
Fan just looked down to the floor. Kulap Shamroon turned and left through the door without another word. Chapter 38. The sleek black Mercedes sedan turned onto Royal City Avenue Alley, slowed to allow well-dressed pedestrians to pass at a crosswalk, then immediately found itself locked in bumper-to-bumper traffic. It was midnight, still just a little early for the real action in all the nightclubs on both sides of the street here, but the crowd seemed to be out in full force, and the lines at the best clubs were already long and getting longer by the minute. In the back of the Mercedes, a white man in his 30s adjusted his cufflinks and looked out at the mass of people all around him. It was a Thursday night, but the sheer number of partiers in the area cast a vibe that felt like New Year's Eve. And all these civilians made Court Gentry a little nervous. He had a feeling about tonight, a sense that something could go wrong, and in Gentry's world, wrong usually involved danger to those in close proximity to him. So as he looked around from the back of the luxury sedan at the hundreds of people here in the flashy Royal City Avenue neighborhood of Bangkok, he did not see happy young partiers out for a good time. He saw potential innocent bystanders, would-be collateral damage. He pushed away the thought. He had every intention of taking things slow and easy this evening, and anyway, how much trouble could he really start himself without a damn gun? He'd asked for a piece when the agency outfitted him for his work here in Bangkok, but Brewer had forbidden it. He was here for recon only. He wouldn't need a weapon, or so said the woman who Court imagined hadn't left the safety of Langley in years. He let it go. He wasn't thinking about shooting up Bangkok. He was thinking about Fitzroy, about Fawn, and once in a while he was even thinking about running from all this. But he knew that was more a fantasy than a plan. He had a deal with CIA and an obligation to Fitz, and he had a feeling that if he didn't get to Fan Xiang first, the Chinese or the Russians would, and either of those outcomes would be damaging to the interests of the United States. As he rode in the back of the Mercedes, the stark change in Court's situation was not lost on him. 4 nights ago, he had been chest deep in muck in the Mekong Delta, tearing leeches from his waterlogged skin and swatting bugs on his face. Now he sat here in a sleek black Mercedes S550, as it caught the eyes of many of the passers-by. He wore a gray virgin-wool Tom Ford suit and a black silk Forziere necktie. His black leather Dolce & Gabbana derby shoes cost more than most people in Thailand made in 4 months, and the watch on his wrist shone gold, the face read Panerai, and it was a style that went for no less than 12 grand in the luxury shops around Bangkok. But as was normally the case with the American in the back of the hired car, all was not as it seemed. The watch was a knockoff, the suit was off the rack, and was to be handed back to CIA station before he left town, and the Mercedes, while expensive, was only here to drop him off. He planned on taking a rented 4-door Toyota parked near his destination back to his hotel. Court had been in Bangkok nearly 4 days, and in that time he'd accomplished little other than establishing his cover. He had a room at the 5-star Okura Prestige. He had clothes and accessories from the upscale shops. He had a new haircut, and most of the visible bug bites, scrapes, and bruises from his time in Vietnam and Cambodia had disappeared from view. But as late as this afternoon, he did not have any idea where to find Fan Xiang. Then Suzanne Brewer came through. He called to check in as he had done each day since he arrived, and she explained that Fan himself had slipped a cryptic identifier into a message received by the U.S. Embassy in Taiwan. Brewer explained, "We know he is being held by the Shamroon Syndicate, and we know he is trying to inform Taiwan of his situation. His correspondence must be monitored by the gangsters with him, because all he communicated was an encrypted SOS and the Chinese characters for Funky Monkey, his handle."
Court asked, "Did the Taiwanese tell us this, or are we monitoring the Taiwanese covertly?"
Brewer hesitated.
"That is something you don't need to know,"
Court replied.
"Actually, I do. If the Taiwanese told us directly, then maybe the Russians don't know about it. But if we glean that intel from Taiwan secure comms, it's a fair bet the Russians have the same capability. I need to know if the Russians are coming for Fan in Bangkok. Trust me, that was news that would have been helpful in Hong Kong and in Vietnam."
Brewer replied,
"I don't have the authority to answer your question. I'm sorry, Violator. It's as simple as that."
Then connect me with someone who does. I want Hanley to tell me, or for him to allow you to do it.
Brewer snapped now. I am your handler. You will not circumvent my authority.
Court didn't really have a way to contact Matt Hanley directly. He knew where the man lived, so theoretically he could have mailed him a letter. But he doubted he could just call some extension at Langley and ask to be put through to the director of the National Clandestine Service. Brewer was right. She was his lifeline, and she was being stubborn. But Court let it go, because there was no time to waste. She had delivered time-sensitive information that Court had to act on immediately. Namely, Court had to get himself to a particular nightclub this evening. While the head of the Shamroon Syndicate was the 75-year-old who started the group in the 1970s, all the operational leadership were young, wealthy, and ostentatious, including Natapon and Kulap Shamroon, sons of the founder. They spent their days overseeing drug trafficking and computer crime and prostitution and extortion rackets, but their nights were spent blowing their money. The Black Pearl nightclub was one of dozens of locations owned by the organization, but the local CIA station had pegged it as one of the main hangouts for the big shots in the group. Tonight, Brewer had explained to Court, a well-known European DJ was booked there for one night only, and Brewer's research into the group told her it was an absolute given that senior members of Shamroon's second generation of leadership would be in attendance. She'd sent Court dossiers and digital images of the syndicate's main players, and then she told him to use whatever means he had at his disposal to locate Fawn. She suggested he go in cover to the Black Pearl, get eyes on the leadership of the organization, and size up their entourage. If he could find a way to isolate a senior member from his security, then Court could press him for details about Fawn's location. It was clear to Court she was telling him to kidnap and possibly even torture. But as Court was an agent of the CIA and not a direct employee of the CIA, and since Brewer had not used either of the words kidnap or torture, the CIA was in the clear, no matter what he did this evening. But Brewer stressed again, as she had done at every single step of Court's operation, that SAD ground branch operatives were in the area and ready to act on Court's intel. Getting a table or even gaining entrance to the Black Pearl was no simple affair, especially for a big event like the DJ's appearance tonight, but Court found a way. He was booked on the executive level of one of the most luxurious hotels in the city. Instead of having the local CIA station work to get him admittance to tonight's big event, Court simply walked down the hall to the concierge, explained he was a big fan of the Dutch DJ, and gave the woman working there a smile and $100 worth of baht, the local currency. He told her the money was hers either way, but he would appreciate any help she could give him. And, just like that, he received a call from the concierge an hour later, letting him know he would have his name on a list at the front door and a private table for two inside. Now Court walked to the entrance of the Black Pearl alone, passing the forward end of the block-long rope line of beautiful people waiting to get through the door. He spoke with a bouncer wearing a headset and holding a clipboard, passed the man 1,000 baht, or 30 bucks, tucked into a friendly handshake, along with a request for an out-of-the-way spot overlooking the action, and soon he was led by a beautiful hostess to a small table along a silk-curtained wall on a mezzanine overlooking the main dance floor and stage of the nightclub. He flipped off the light at his table, ordered a Johnny Walker Black on Ice, and sat there in the low light. The club was filling up quickly, the dance music was pumping, and the lights and fog were working in sync. Massive crystalline chandeliers hung over the entire floor, and the lights projected on them and through them pulsed with the beat. Court looked around at the lavish establishment and wished he were instead sitting alone in a dockside Irish pub, a few stools down the bar from a couple of grumpy old men, to listen in on for entertainment. The Black Pearl wasn't his scene. At 1 a.m., the DJ from Amsterdam took the stage and the crowd went insane. The music to Court wasn't quite as loud as an M249 machine gun firing cyclic, but it was damn close, and as far as Court was concerned, the noise of a gunfight was much more creative and interesting than this mindless and repetitive thumping and squawking. Still, he pretended he enjoyed it and hoped like hell he was pulling it off, despite the fact that he'd much rather listen to someone slaughter livestock. The loud music and the crazed lighting effects inside the venue made surveillance difficult, to say the least, but Court had been eyeing a roped-off set of three crescent-shaped tables next to the dance floor and just to the left of the stage, expecting any Shamroon Syndicate players to head straight there if they came in the building. At 1:30, Court was moving his head with the thunderous music, nursing a scotch slowly, acting like one of the thousands of rich international businessmen he'd seen during his years traveling around the world. He'd brushed off several attempts by prostitutes to sit down and join him, and other tries by young local girls here, hoping to score bottles of champagne off a rich tourist almost old enough to be their father. After one such rebuff, Court looked back to the roped-off tables, and then he looked away. A group of about 20 men and women were in the process of sitting down, and although Court realized he would not be able to ID faces from this distance and in these conditions by the impeccable suits worn by the men and the obvious beauty and glamorous clothing of the women sitting with them, he felt confident the Shamroon Syndicate was in the house. Several bodyguards stood at the VIP rope, and a couple more stood behind the tables on either side of the entourage. The guards all faced out, hands clasped in front of them, and Court imagined they would be armed with handguns. This didn't scare him. In fact, it pleased him, because Court knew where he could obtain a pistol if things started to go downhill around here. He glanced sporadically towards the VIP area. As far as he could tell, all the men sitting at the tables behind the rope were Thai, and all the women European, other than one lady in a sheer blue dress who appeared to be of African descent. There were 14 females to 5 males, and 6 of the women seemed huddled especially close to one male, who sat at the center of the middle table by the dance floor. This screwed with the female-to-male ratio for the other men in the VIP lounge, but the guy getting the attention from the 6 girls didn't seem to care. Court wondered if this guy could possibly be either Natapong or Kulap Shamroon, who were brothers and the sons of Ponit Shamroon, the man who'd founded the syndicate 35 years earlier by bringing various disparate criminal enterprises in Thailand under one umbrella. He'd seen pictures of both brothers, but they looked so much alike Court couldn't tell who he was looking at across the smoky dance floor. Brewer's dossier on the group, which Court had just finished reading in his hotel room when he got the call that his car had arrived, told him Natapong spent more time in Bangkok while Kulap traveled regularly on syndicate business, so odds were this was the former, but it didn't really matter to Court. He felt certain either one of the Shamroon brothers would know where Fan Xiang was being held. Once Court established that he had eyes on people who could tell him what he wanted to know, he scanned the crowds both below him and up there with him on the mezzanine for any glimpse of others interested in this information. This was third-party awareness, the simple personal security act of realizing you and your target aren't alone in the world, that someone else might be watching them, or watching you. Court had been surprised twice in the past week by others moving on the same objective as he, and he didn't want it to happen again. He looked in the best places in the bar to get eyes on the VIP section. Court himself had a good view, but he was relatively exposed in the center of the mezzanine above the dance floor. A better location to surveil the VIP area was up on the mezzanine but tucked into either corner, where the lighting wasn't as good. Court looked idly to his left and then to his right, his head still thumping along with the music. And then his head stopped.
Well, that didn't take long.
A Western-looking man in his 40s, dressed not unlike Court himself, sat in the dark corner on Court's right, just beyond the staircase down to the dance floor. His eyes were on the VIP section below, just as Court's had been. And also like Court, the man in the corner lifted his head and began scanning his surroundings. Just then, a Thai girl who had tried and failed to get free drinks from Court a half hour earlier passed by with a girlfriend. Court reached out and took her by the arm, pulling her playfully towards him and down on his lap.
"Where have you been?"
Court asked, suddenly interested in talking.
"Oh, hi,"
she replied, pleasantly surprised that she'd finally managed to get this rich-looking foreigner's attention. Court said,
"I seem to remember from our earlier conversation that you really like Cristal."
She smiled.
"I do."
He looked at her friend now, who was already slipping into the seat across from him.
"And how about you?"
She smiled herself.
"Of course."
"You both enjoy expensive champagne? That's crazy! What are the chances?"
His new friend's name was Sky, or that was her story anyway, and her friend claimed that her name was Nikki. Court saw their bullshit and raised them, telling them his name was Bob, and he was a yacht salesman from Florida in the U.S. of A. He ordered a bottle of 2006 Cristal Brut from a passing waitress, and while they waited, they mostly listened to the music, because this wasn't exactly a venue where people could chat easily, even if they had something to talk about. Court was glad he didn't have to make too much idle banter. He was already thinking about the man in the corner, who he felt certain was here in an operational capacity. He had a slightly Slavic look to him, so Russian was his best guess, but he thought the man looked older and heavier than he would expect from a Zaslon operator, which meant he wouldn't have been one of the men he'd seen in Vietnam. Still, he could have been an SVR. Either way, Court knew what he had to do. He needed to get closer to the VIP area to identify key personalities and to decide how he would go about separating one of the top dogs of the Shamroon Syndicate from his bodyguards. So for one of the first times in his operational life, Court decided he needed to get up and dance. The Cristal came, and Court and the two ladies each downed a flute of champagne, Court thinking all along about how he was glad he didn't have to turn in an expense report to Colonel Dye, because this $500 purchase of bubbly would probably result in Don Fitzroy getting one of his feet lopped off. When they finished the drink, Nikki moved on to find a sucker of her own, and Court took Skye down to the dance floor, passing near the lone man in the corner by the stairs as they did so. Court snuck a glance in the man's direction when he reached the stairs and saw that the man's attention was fully fixed on the VIP section and the large contingent of Thai men and non-Thai women sitting there. And, Court noticed, the man had a bottle of vodka on ice next to his table and a glass in his hand. This didn't necessarily mean he was Russian, but it didn't hurt the chances that Court had him pegged correctly. On the floor, Skye and Bob pressed in with hundreds of others, but within minutes, without Skye having any clue she was being used as cover in an intelligence operation for the United States, they found themselves near the roped-off VIP section. Court noticed that several of the men and women had left the tables, presumably to dance themselves, but the floor was too tight for Court to see any of the known subjects of his surveillance. It didn't matter, though, because the one Thai man still sitting behind the rope was most definitely 28-year-old Natapong Shamroon. Shamroon still had the six women sitting close to him, pouring his drinks and leaning in close whenever he spoke. Court put five of them as Central or Eastern European, and the other as African, African-American, or perhaps even from the Caribbean because of her dark skin. In their stilettos, the women were all probably taller than Natapong when they stood up, and one brunette was a full head taller, but gauging by the cool grin on Shamroon's face, he seemed fine with the height disparity. The women appeared to all be in their 20s, and they wore a lot of makeup, just like all the women in the nightclub, but even up close, there wasn't one who was not breathtaking. As Court and Skye got a little closer, now it was Skye who was pulling them in the direction of the VIP section because she wanted to see the exotic women and their flashy clothes. Court noticed all six ladies had dark and serious faces. Despite their bright and luminous clothing and outwardly poised mannerisms, Court read the eyes of a couple of the girls, and he determined in an instant they weren't here of their own volition. As he and Skye made their way back towards the stairs up to the mezzanine, Court realized he'd seen expressions like these before in his career, traveling through various terrible places. These women were victims of human trafficking. Prostitutes certainly working here in Bangkok for Shamroon's own organization. Brewer's notes on the syndicate had told him hundreds of young Central European women each year were offered good jobs in the hotel or hospitality industries in Asia, and when they arrived, they were drugged, threatened, beaten, and forced into prostitution. Their passports were taken from them. Local police were often in on the scheme, so the young girls had no one but one another to rely on. Soon, though, they would be moved around and administered huge quantities of drugs and alcohol, and they would give in totally to their situations. Some would make their way back home after a time, but many would not. Court didn't get a close look at all the girls around Natapong Shamroon, but he saw enough in the compliant, dead eyes of a couple of them to know the score. They wouldn't like Natapong, but they'd be dependent on him, and this meant the girls could pose a problem if Court wanted to get him out of here, because they were all over him, and he wasn't sure they'd even leave his side if he went to the bathroom. Bob and Sky returned to the table, and soon the bottle of Cristal came to an end. When he declined to order another, so did Bob's whirlwind relationship with Sky. She wandered off. To Court's pleasure, her next mark was the guy in the corner with the vodka bottle and the shifty eyes, though this man sent her on her way gruffly and continued eyeing the nightclub. The Dutch DJ took a smoke break a minute later, and though the pre-recorded music was still loud, the crowd wasn't as engaged, so Court took advantage of the relative calm to place a phone call. Court called Brewer, established his identity, and quickly told her he wanted the SAD men in the area to create a distraction. Brewer replied to Court's request instantly.
Negative. I'm not sending Ground Branch in until you have positive ID on Fawn.
Court sighed.
Look, there is too much security here for me to do this myself.
Do you have PID on Fawn?
Negative, but I have an opportunity to get one of the brothers. I just need some help.
Brewer said,
if you want someone to help you get a prisoner out of that nightclub, you know who you can call.
Court understood what she meant, but he didn't like it.
There are 500 civilians in this building. If Dai's men get involved, this could turn into a bloodbath.
You'll just have to take care of everything inside the building. Make it clear to him what you need. His men stay outside. Their job is to help you out of the area.
Court didn't hide his frustration.
Great idea, Brewer, but I don't have a gun, remember?
You'll come up with something,
Brewer said coldly.
I'm under orders myself, Violator. Ground Branch is a single-shot weapon. They swoop in for the snatch. They aren't a force I can order around to flex muscle every time you want to question someone.
But,
Brewer said,
if you get PID on Fawn, call me back. Otherwise, the Chinese can help you tonight.
Court hung up. As far as he was concerned, Brewer might have had her orders, but using Chinese intelligence operatives was just going to increase the chances something bad would happen tonight. Still, it wasn't his call to make. He looked down at his phone and keyed another number. He put a finger into one of his ears and his phone tight against the other. He could barely hear the ringing of the phone, but Dai's voice came through loud and clear.
What is all that noise?
Court said,
I'm in a nightclub called the Black Pearl. It's a bar owned by the Shamroon Syndicate. I'm going to make a move on a member of their leadership who is here, and I need your men to help.
Dai said,
I am glad to hear you are doing something proactive, finally. But why do you think Shamroon is the one holding Fan Xiang?
It is the biggest group around, and it has the most reach. Shamroon Syndicate operatives smuggle through Cambodia, and were likely the ones who picked up Fan there. And I've been asking around, and they are the only group who can really employ a man with our target skills. They have a large cybercrime operation run out of the city.
That is all you're going on?
Court faked a defensive tone.
Look, I don't know for sure, but I need to force a move. Natapong Shamroon himself is here. If I can get him out of here in some place where I can work on him, I'll find out where Fawn is, or I'll find out who else might be holding him.
Dai said nothing. He clearly was not convinced. Court played his trump card.
Did I mention that the Russians are here? They have eyes on Shamroon as we speak.
Now Dai spoke.
I have 4 men just minutes from you. I can have a dozen men there in less than a half hour.
Thought that might get your attention. Tell them they are just here to back me up. I'll wait for an opportunity for Natapong to—
Court had been watching the VIP area below while he spoke. Now, right in front of him, Natapong Shamroon and his group downed their full glasses of whiskey and began shuffling the girls with them towards a door at the rear of the VIP area. 3 bodyguards moved along with them. When the door opened, Court realized it led to a stairwell. Shamroon and his entourage were already on the ground floor, and he saw the bodyguards leading them up the stairs, with the girls following behind. More men stood waiting on the stairs, and Court took them as security for Shamroon's entourage as well. He hadn't seen these men in the nightclub and wondered what they had been doing up until now. The VIP door closed before Court could get a head count or be sure everyone was going up, but he felt it was a safe bet. Brewer had told him that above the Black Pearl, a private club and spa entertained the rich of the city during the day, and it served as an occasional playground of the Shamroon Syndicate's leadership in the off-hours.
Are you still there?
Dai asked. Now Court waved at his waitress to bring the check. Into his phone, he said,
I might have an opportunity to get closer to Shamroon. Keep your guys outside and ready to help me make it out of here with a captive. And hurry them up. I don't control the timetable with this. The bad guys do.
I will do as you say.
Remember, Dai, they stay outside.